So I know that when the Nobel Prize announcement is made, the text that gets used there is sometimes a little bit cryptic. And if you're not in the field, you don't know these guys, you don't know what they did. So I thought I would try to explain to you what it was that these two fellows did and what their groups did that merited getting this Nobel Prize. So the key words here I'm going to highlight at the bottom are the fact that they were doing things with individual quantum systems. These are experimental physicists doing things with individual quantum systems. So what does an individual quantum system mean? Well, I think one of the things we can do is try to crack open a quantum mechanics textbook and see what we find first. And as a UCLA professor, of course, I'm partial to Sakurai. So if we look in the first chapter or second chapter of Sakurai, one of the first things we run into is harmonic oscillator, okay? It doesn't get much simpler than that in terms of quantum mechanics. We have some kind of a phase space where there's this trajectory that will go around in phase space. I was happy to see everybody got a yo-yo in their goodie bags for this conference. So if you really press me on some of these phase space issues, I can try to do a poor demo with the yo-yo I have. But essentially, the mathematics involved are these creation and annihilation operators for the excitations. So that's chapter two, I think, of Sakurai. And then you move on to chapter three, and you get to the next individual quantum system that might exist, and that's essentially a spin one-half particle. So these are the two ingredients that these two fellows used, and this is essentially what they're being cited for in the Nobel Prize announcement. Now, this is pretty simple stuff. You don't actually need Sakurai to understand any of this. You can really get away with something quite a bit more mundane. I'm not talking about complicated Hartree, Fock, all of this stuff. I mean, I went to the condensed matter session earlier today. It was fantastic. There are some people in this audience who I know are very, very sophisticated quantum mechanics themselves, okay? But this is not what we need to know in order to understand what these guys did. So what I'll say is that the concepts are very simple that I'm going to be talking about. It's just the experiments themselves that are so impressive. So the thing that ties these two pictures together, what do these two things have in common? Well, maybe not so much, but what we can do is trade off excitations between spin one-half particles and harmonic oscillators in principle. And so if you decide to write down a Hamiltonian that involves that, what you come up with is probably something that has a name, even if you didn't know it. It's called the James-Cummings Hamiltonian. And this is the most complicated equation I'm going to show in the entire talk, okay? So don't get too worried. I'm not going to turn on the afterburners here, okay? So the first term, this is not so hard. What we're talking about is there's an atom and it has an excited state and a ground state, and there's an energy difference between them. That's this omega EG. That's all that term means. Okay, we've got just our Pauli Z operator. The second term, I think, almost certainly is familiar to everyone in this room. We've got a harmonic oscillator, and we know what the Hamiltonian for that system looks like in terms of those operators. And then the magic is in the third step, and it too is, simply put, not very complicated, okay? We have some coupling terms where, for instance, we can excite the atom while at the same time annihilating a quantum from a harmonic oscillator. That makes some sense, okay? If the energies are matched, then we've got conservation of energy, that's good. We can also de-excite the atom while producing a quantum of harmonic oscillation. So this is the physics that we're talking about. It's really the magic is in the experiments here. So with these two tools, what Dave Wineland and Serge Haroche were able to accomplish is essentially a laundry list of buzzwords here, okay? I mean, they were able to do a tremendous amount of different kind of fundamental, almost Gedanken experiments, but they were doing them in the lab. So I'm gonna just list a few of these. So we've got cooling mechanical oscillators to the ground state, state tomography, quantum jumps, negative probabilities, quantum Zeno, the controlled NOT gate, which I think is familiar to many of the people here at the Perimeter Institute, certainly, multi-qubit entanglement, measurement at the 10 to the minus 17 level. I'll talk more about that later. That's completely insane. I mean, that is just unbelievable, in my opinion. I'll tell you about it at the end of the talk. Quantum non-demolition measurement, measurement beyond the standard quantum limit, quantum error correction. We've got some algorithms that can be demonstrated. Grover's search and Shor's algorithm, cavity quantum electrodynamics. Okay, GHZ states, EPR states, Dickey states, squeeze states, Fock states, Noon states, cat states, dog states, iguana states. All right, it's late in the day. Did you guys, okay, you didn't fall for those last two. But, I mean, you can essentially just go through the list of all the more or less small number of qubit type operations you can do and look up the physics associated with those, and that's what these two guys were able to do. It's quite impressive. This slide originally was two slides. I mean, you can just keep going with this all you want, really. So all of this comes from our simple Hamiltonian here. This is our theory slide. Again, it doesn't get any more complicated than that in terms of the theory. What's going on with the experiments? Well, I'll start off with Dave Wineland here. He has to choose a harmonic oscillator if we want to implement this James Cummings Hamiltonian in order to get access to all of these fancy physics associated with all those buzzwords. Okay, his harmonic oscillator is phonons. So it turns out that he is using, for his spin 1/2 particles, trapped atomic ions. Ions will be oscillating in these traps. We can view that as being phonons, and there we have our two pieces that are necessary. On the other hand, Serge Haroche was dealing with different systems. He was using photons for this quantum harmonic oscillator. So these are both, it turns out, extremely well described by that simple Hamiltonian I was telling you about. They really are very harmonic. And for his spin 1/2 particles, it turns out he was using things called Rydberg atoms, which really, they're just regular atoms, but they're in very high excitation states, and you can think of them as being kind of a classical, almost Keplerian orbit of this electron around some charged nucleus and all the other electrons. So the last thing I'm going to do in an effort to eliminate even more equations is just to point out that there's a nice visualization technique. Many of you are familiar with this, but if not, it's called the Bloch sphere. The idea is that if we take a two-level system and it is in a pure state and we write that state in polar coordinates here, we just write, you can write any of these pure states in that form, you can say that state of that atom or the qubit or the quasi-spin, whatever you want to call it, is described as a unit vector that starts at the origin and points somewhere on the surface of this Bloch sphere. So spin up would be the North Pole, spin down would be the South Pole. Anything on the equator is like a 50-50 superposition state. So you got 1/√2s kicking around there, but then there's the phase relationship between the two. That determines where you are on the equator there, and this will be a helpful tool for us. So there are a lot of folks who are fairly familiar, I think, with some of the condensed matter tools that get used in the field. I'm gonna try to argue here that atoms are excellent, excellent quantum systems, okay? We know how to control them extremely well, how to do all the operations we need in terms of entropy and so forth. We know how to isolate them from their environment, which of course is going to be crucial for observing any quantum effects. We can essentially levitate them in the middle of ultra-high vacuum chambers. They're all identical, okay? Since we're not making them using some lithographic patterning or something like that, we're essentially guaranteed that every rubidium-87 atom is exactly the same, okay? We can initialize them into the same initial state. They are identical. We have superpositions that live for a long time because we can actually interact with the atoms for a long time. We know how to trap them and hold them in one place. And then last, I'll say atoms are inexpensive, but really what I mean is atoms number 2 through n are really inexpensive. Getting that first one is super expensive, okay? I'm not gonna lie. That takes a lot. But if you once you have one working, essentially the idea is that you can put more in there. So I'm estimating this as 10^-23. Okay, since we're at an international conference, you got some conversions here, so choose your choose your currency. It is on the order of extremely cheap. All right, that's the idea. So which atoms can we use for all of this stuff? Well, we have a few choices. We would like some properties. We want an effective spin 1/2 particle for doing this qubit. You know, this pseudo-spin, if you will. That means we need two states that are very long-lived. If the excited state is constantly decaying into the ground state, then we are not going to be able to maintain our quantum information. So aside from that, we also want to be able to control these things. We need to have a short-lived state, a third state, in order to do all of the operations associated with entropy. We want to be able to cool the thing. We want to be able to initialize it. We want to be able to read out the state of these atoms. It turns out that we can do that by using a short-lived state as well. And when I say cooling, what I mean here is that we're going to do laser cooling of these atoms. We're interested in their motion. And this was a tremendously powerful advance in the field. And I think a lot of people maybe don't know that Dave Wineland was one of the inventors of laser cooling. And one of the reasons that you may not know that is because if you look at his paper, it has probably I'll say the most understated title imaginable, considering how exciting this work was, okay? You haven't heard of Dave Lionland doing laser cooling probably because if you read this title, you have no idea what's going on there. If he had titled it laser cooling with 7 exclamation points, that would have been more appropriate, okay? The content of this article is amazing. This is tremendous work. It was just a little bit of a different kind of understated, very characteristically understated approach in the publication. So, we want things that are simple and have the short-lived state and a long-lived state. Okay, what's more simple than hydrogen when we're talking about atoms? So, if we think of atomic hydrogen, there's an electron and we have a proton. It's pretty easy. There's a doublet spin 1/2 and a doublet spin 1/2, a doublet s 1/2 excited state. This would be a pretty good qubit because that excited state actually lives for quite some time. It's got a maybe on the order of 100 millisecond lifetime. So we could choose this as representing our spin 1/2 particle. So we could say that this n equals 2 state is the north pole of the Bloch sphere, the n equals 1 state is the south pole, and just identify those as being this simulated spin or qubit. We also need a short-lived state. There's one of those as well. The doublet p 1/2 state is fantastic. Lives for 2 nanoseconds, which by the way means it's incredibly strong. This would be a fantastic transition. We'd be able to laser cool like mad on this thing. The problem with hydrogen is that the wavelength you need to do this is technologically inconvenient. You're not really going to be able to do a whole lot if you have to do everything at 121 nanometers. It's just more or less an accident of, you know, things being difficult, okay? So we are not going to be able to use hydrogen. So the next best thing to hydrogen is everything that looks like hydrogen. You got a bunch of electrons that are all paired up around the nucleus, and then one electron hanging out in la-la land out there, just orbiting, okay? And that basically means we're talking about the alkali atoms and the coinage metals. These are all doublet s 1/2 ground state atoms. And Serge Haroche chose in particular rubidium here, which is basically the real workhorse of atomic physics. The lasers are very convenient. It's really easy to use. It's got great collisional properties. I mean, it's a fantastic atom. It really is marvelous. So how's he going to make a spin 1/2 particle out of rubidium? Well, we've got a fast transition here for our laser cooling on the doublet S 1/2 to doublet P transition. And while Serge Haroche wasn't necessarily doing laser cooling, some of the things he was doing is a little bit similar to it, this nonetheless is really useful for doing our initialization and so forth. And then we want two states that are really long-lived. And in his case, what they were working with is a harmonic oscillator that is at microwave frequency. So I'll talk about that in maybe 2 slides from now. So we're looking for two states that are separated by maybe tens of gigahertz. And we can get that by looking at the so-called Rydberg states. I told you about these states that are very high principal quantum numbers, big excitations out there. And we can get there by going kind of S to P to S to P to S to P and going all the way up to these Rydberg states. That'd be one way to do it. Now the problem with doing it this way is that the lifetime of those Rydberg states is not that great. So if you did it this way, going S to P all the way up, you would end up with lifetimes on the order of 100 microseconds. You'd really like to do quite a bit better. So what he did instead was work with so-called circular Rydberg states, where they were going way out into large numbers for the orbital angular momentum. So really it's more like S to P to D to F, et cetera. You're out by 50, I don't know, you run out of letters in the alphabet at some point, okay? But basically, these states are very long-lived because in order to decay, they can't go straight from here all the way to the ground state. They have to take each step on the way down because each photon can only carry away one quantum of angular momentum. So we can identify these two states as our qubit. They're fantastic. It turns out that these high angular momentum states are these so-called circular states. It really does look like you have an electron. I mean, it's like a Bohr orbit here. All right, it's an electron orbiting at a very high radius from that proton. Okay, so we've got our spin 1/2 particle. We need microwave, or we need a harmonic oscillator. Haroche developed a microwave cavity for this. It is made of copper coated with niobium, so it's a superconductor at less than 1.4 Kelvin. It has a frequency of about 51 gigahertz, and the spacing between those mirrors is on the order of a couple centimeters. So this is actually a picture of those things. I'm not really sure what's meant to be represented by the light on the inside there, but I don't know. I guess the artist felt that they wanted to put something nice in there. The Q of this cavity is outstanding, okay? It has a Q of about 10 to the 10 to the 10 here, which means that a photon inside this cavity, a 51 gigahertz microwave photon, lives for 130 milliseconds. If you think about a photon living for 130 milliseconds, what you come up with is that the total distance it travels is about 39,000 kilometers, which is almost exactly the circumference of planet Earth. So he's got a tiny cavity here in his laboratory in a cryostat, and the photon is actually going around in there so many times it could encircle the Earth before it actually decays out of that cavity. That's quite remarkable. So how would you even know that? Well, we want to be able to detect what's going on inside that microwave cavity. Now, I told you about the James Cummings Hamiltonian. That's going to be the answer to this question, but a question I can pose is, what would you use to actually measure the photons inside this cavity? They're at microwave frequencies, so it's actually, things get fairly difficult. The world's, nature's best photon detector, I think I would argue, if you're not familiar with it, is the mantis shrimp. If you have never heard of the mantis shrimp, check it out online sometime. They are much better physicists than we are. They have amazing optical eyes. They see in Stokes parameters. It's incredible. However, the mantis shrimp would be a bad detector for these microwaves. It would work with probably delicious results, but we'd like something that is a little bit less destructive than that. So what we're going to do is use these atoms instead. We can actually use the James Cummings Hamiltonian to not only measure what's going on in the cavity, we can actually use it to affect what's going on in the cavity. And that's exactly what Hirosh did. So here's a cartoon illustrating what I mean. If we have this microwave cavity here, and it has no photons in it, and it is exactly on resonance with the atom, that's what I mean by that delta equals zero, we can create one of these Rydberg state atoms, and I'll call this particular state the spin down state, and we can send it through the cavity into a state detector, whatever that state detector is, okay? And if there are no photons in the cavity, it goes through, the state detector says, hey, that was spin down, so we know there were no photons in that cavity. Well, the reason I say we know there were no photons in that cavity is because, conversely, if there had been a photon in there, what would happen, since this is resonant, is in principle this thing would absorb that photon, it would go in our state detector, and if everything's perfect, we would get spin up. Okay? This would be a way of detecting the number of photons in that cavity. But one of the things that's a slight drawback of this is that you only know what the photon number used to be, because you destroyed it. You basically absorbed that photon and took it out of that cavity. So we'd like to do something a little bit more sophisticated if we have any hope of using these photons later for some other tasks. And what, the term that we're talking about here that does this, of course, in the James Cummings Hamiltonian is exactly that one right there. There's an atomic excitation with the annihilation of a photon, okay? Again, this is not a complicated object here mathematically. It really is quite simple. It turns out this coupling strength is about 50 kilohertz in the case of this experiment. So, in order to do this in a way that's a little bit less destructive, what we can do is detune this cavity, and in his case, they were typically doing it by tens of kilohertz, and that means that the photon is not on resonance with the atom. Now, if I have a two-level system and I excite it with a field that is near but not exactly on resonance with that splitting in that atom, what I find is that I get essentially a shift. We call it an AC Stark shift in atomic physics. This goes by about 50 different names in 50 different fields of physics. It's an off-resonant energy shift. It's basically perturbation theory, okay? So what we can do in this case is try to figure out how we're going to measure this energy shift. And the way this is done is by introducing a rotation before the atom gets to the cavity. What we're going to do is send an atom through that cavity that's in a 50-50 superposition of spin up and spin down. And when you go into the math of what you mean by that, well, this is going to be a rotation around the x-axis of the Bloch sphere by some angle pi over 2. We're simply rotating that Bloch vector from the south pole up to the equator when it passes through that cavity. So here we have our rotation. This is the state we get at that point in that process. If there are no photons in the cavity, the atom traverses the cavity, nothing happens. Then we want to read out the state, so we do another rotation around the same axis of the Bloch sphere and send it into our detector. If there was no phase evolution between those two events, what we did was a rotation around x, so now the Bloch vector is pointing along minus y, then nothing happened, and then we get a rotation around x again, so we get all the way up to the North Pole. All right. Now what happens if there had been a photon in there? Well, we have a similar thing at the very beginning. We end up in the same state there, but after passing through this cavity, There is a phase shift here. There's a slight phase difference between spin up and spin down. And if we've played our cards right in engineering exactly what that phase difference is, it turns out that we can make it so that after this atom traverses through the second microwave region, the second rotation, it's now in spin down again. So spin up means that there was no photons. Spin down means that we had a photon. And this has been able to measure the number state of photons in this cavity without actually changing the number of photons. So if you started in a number state, either 0 or 1, okay, you end up being still in a number state when you're done with this. So Hirosh likes to call this something called a quantum non-demolition measurement. That's what he means by quantum non-demolition. If it was in a number state, it is still in a number state when you're done with it. So this whole process goes by a lot of different names. One of them is to call it a Ramsey sequence, okay? And if you don't know what a Ramsey sequence is, it's what I just showed you, but here's what's happening on the blocksphere. We start and spin down. We do a rotation by pi over 2 around the x-axis. Something interesting happens, whatever it is in here. And then we do an analysis pulse, another pi over 2, and we measure the state of this thing. It's a great way for doing lots of different things. It's the bread and butter in the laboratory of quantum information. You're always putting, you want to benchmark some process, you're almost always putting it right in here to see what happened to the thing. It's a tremendously powerful technique. One of the things that I think if you had talked to Norm Ramsey about this, he would have told you that it's essentially a Michelson interferometer, this technique, okay? It's just in the time domain. So what I did was I looked up Michelson-Morley paper. This is exactly the figure from the Michelson-Morley paper. We can map everything right onto this. So if you don't learn anything else in this talk, but you do learn that a Ramsey sequence is the same thing as a Michelson interferometer, I'm going to be okay with that, all right? So here's how the thing works. Well, we start off with our atom here, and it is in some state, by which I mean it's impinging on this beam splitter from one direction or the other. It then gets split into two pieces, which is the same thing as that pi over 2 pulse around the x-axis, okay? So this is our rotation now. We then have to have the phase shift due to, for instance, a photon. We have to put two copies of the thing now just because geometrically it has to go both places. But the spin up state will go in along one path, spin down will go along the other path. What happens is there's a relative phase shift there between those two guys due to the presence of the photon. I can collect it all in this term phi right here. And then we have our second pi over 2 pulse, which is just those things interfering again on that beam splitter, and then we measure what we get out of there. So this is really all that's going on in this extremely powerful technique that is usually called Ramsey spectroscopy, okay? So I will say maybe as a last note on Hirosh's work, his most recent work was actually demonstrating stabilization of photon number states inside this cavity. So this is a little bit more complicated. There's some, you know, funny bells and whistles going on here, but essentially what they were doing is measuring the number state in the cavity, and they would keep measuring it, and if it changed, they would tell a little microwave oscillator here, hey, we need another photon, and it would basically put another photon in there. So they're able to produce a specific number of state of microwave photons on demand now. This is essentially a technological advance, but so is this whole Nobel Prize. I mean, the point is we're developing quantum technologies. The idea is in the future we think there's a lot of room for applications that utilize quantum mechanics in a fundamental way, and these are really our kind of baby steps toward that goal. So a very impressive system in order to be able to do that. I think that this talk is going to be available online afterwards, so I encourage you to look up these papers here if you're interested in reading more about Hirosh's work. So I'm going to step back now to go back to Dave Wineland. What was he doing with, remember, he had phonons and ions, okay? This was his way of building up that James Cummings Hamiltonian. Well, if we are interested in things that are simple, we can laser cool them, et cetera. We already talked about the alkali atoms and the coinage metals. But if you're going to use something that is an ion, you need something that's going to look like that once you've ripped off at least one electron. And in our case here, it is going to be exactly one electron. So you move over one column to the right, and you get the alkaline earth atoms. You get the zinc family here. You get this total weirdo down here, ytterbium. Happens to be my favorite. But just assume for the moment that it's an honorary alkaline earth atom. Okay. So the structure of all of these atoms is very similar. There's a doublet S, 1/2 ground state, again, just like rubidium. And they tend to have a fairly low-lying D state here. The nice thing about that D state is this is essentially a forbidden transition. This guy tends to live for quite some time. It's a great qubit. We already have our qubit now, okay? It's not the only way to make a qubit in these atoms, but this is probably the easiest to explain. So we just identify one of these as being spin up, we identify the other one as being spin down, and then we can talk about everything in the spin language. So that's good. The other thing we needed was we needed a handle. We have to be able to do things to this atom. We have to be able to read it out. And so we can use the p state for that. It's a short-lived state. And as long as it doesn't tend to decay into this d state, which you can essentially engineer by choosing things correctly, we'll be good. So we can use our photon scattering there. It turns out it's quite easy to image even a single atomic ion in one of these traps. In particular, in the case of barium, you can actually see a single atom with your eye. You can look in that vacuum chamber, and it'll be glowing green. You can see a single atom. It's quite remarkable. So what do I mean when I say it's levitating in the vacuum chamber? Well, we want to isolate it from its environment. That's the whole name of the game here. This is why quantum mechanics, you know, is difficult as an experimental science. So one thing you would say is that it's charged. We could just surround it with a whole bunch of positive charges. This was certainly my first thought, but when you think about it a little harder, you realize that that's really not that bright. Essentially, Gauss's law tells you that that is not going to confine a particle, okay? So Maxwell's equations essentially mean that you can't do that. So what we're going to do instead is we're going to use time-dependent electric fields to produce this confinement. And the time-dependent electric field method, this is Wolfgang Pauli, it's called a Pauli trap. It works a little bit like this. What we have at any instant in time is a saddle point potential, and we're going to flip the sign of that thing back and forth in a sinusoidal way, okay? And the nice thing about giving a talk to a graduate student audience is we can invoke the world's master of determining whether something is a trap or not. So we've got our particle in here in this quantum motor potential. Admiral Akbar says, it's a trap, exactly. And we've got our ion trap. So here it is. This is what it looks like in the chamber. One way of manifesting this is to have four rods that have an RF electric field on them on the diagonals. You've got DC on the other two diagonals and then some end caps on there. And these ions tend to gather in a so-called Coulomb crystal in the middle here. If you've played your cards right, they'll be in a linear chain. They'll be nice and cold. You can laser cool them. They're fantastically well isolated from their environment. So this is what it looks like in the lab. Every atomic physics lab, it seems, has, you know, a forest of optics on a table and some kind of vacuum chamber involved in it in some way or another. What we have are actual images of these ions. Again, you can see them quite easily. This doesn't involve super high-tech microscopy. They're actually very far apart. They repel one another quite strongly. So the motion of these ions in the trap is what produces our phonons. And if we imagine just a one-dimensional situation here with two ions, we can see that they're going to have two modes of motion. There's going to be a center of mass mode of motion, where they're both moving together. That's an extremely good harmonic oscillator. There's also a stretch mode of motion. That's also an extremely good harmonic oscillator. And by putting together some video or some pictures of static ions, you can kind of make some semi-fake looking oscillation pictures of these ions in here. It really illustrates the point here. These are only two of the possible modes of these ions. There are much more complicated modes. It's just you can't really put together movies like this for those particular modes. So these things are well understood. We know how to control them. So that's a fantastic way of getting our harmonic oscillator. So now let's build up the interaction. We want to have excitations of the two-level system trade off with excitations of the harmonic oscillator. The harmonic oscillator excitations tend to be in the range of maybe a megahertz, but this S to D transition is some terahertz, okay? So basically, we're going to have to get a photon involved here in order to make up the difference. We don't need to treat it necessarily in an incredibly quantum way. Just imagine that the photon takes care of conservation of energy for you. So if I just shine light on here that's resonant with that S to D transition, it's called the carrier, and we don't change the number of phonons in our system. Number of phonons in spin down is the same as the number of phonons in spin up if we drive this thing all the way. We can also detune that light by this 1 megahertz shift, by one harmonic oscillator quantum. That actually is called the first red sideband, and that accomplishes changing the motional state while we're doing the spin flip. Likewise, we can drive the first blue sideband, where we have detuned in the positive direction with one quantum of energy. There are also second order sidebands. There are sidebands associated with every mode of these ions in this trap, so we have lots of different harmonic oscillators to choose from, lots of ways to interact with them. So if we think back to this first red sideband, what's going on with the James Cummings Hamiltonian there? Well, once again, we have the first red sideband, of course, is represented by this term right here. if we started in spin down. We've got an excitation of our atom, and we are eliminating one quantum of motion from that thing. So to give you an idea of what the parameters are experimentally, it's about a megahertz for this Rabi frequency where you're driving these sidebands. An interesting thing to consider is, what if we drive this transition halfway? So instead of going all the way from spin down with n phonons to spin up with n minus 1 phonons, what if we stop halfway in the middle? Let's call it a pi over 2 pulse, much like this Ramsey scheme. And what we get is a very interesting state here, pretty easy to see. You end up with an entangled state at that point. So this is a fantastic slide due to Chris Monroe. It shows how you might operate this. We do something to an ion here that produces a phonon excitation only if it's in a certain internal state. Maybe it's in a superposition state. We then do something to some other ion only if there's a phonon. And remember, there's a superposition of phonons at that point. And then we undo the entanglement with the phonon bath, or the phonon degree of freedom, rather, on that first ion. And what we get is that the internal states of these two ions are entangled with one another. And this is how Dave Wineland was able to do these algorithm demonstrations. A lot of that whole laundry list of fun stuff was essentially done using this technique. There's another technique that's a little bit more advanced that is also used, but this is the so-called Serac-Zoller gate. And then last, I want to talk about clocks. If you want to choose a transition that's really good for making an atomic clock, it turns out that singlet S0 to triplet P0 is pretty much the best you're going to be able to do in an atom. It's unbelievably robust. It doesn't get affected by lots of different types of perturbations. If you want an atom that has that structure, what you find is that you end up going to this kind of 3B column here. Also, lutetium is kind of an honorary member of that. And if you look at the math of what these things might be susceptible to, turns out aluminum is a really good choice. So we have an aluminum plus ion in our trap. It makes an incredibly good clock. This state lives for 20 seconds. Problem is, you can't really laser cool this thing. It doesn't have a short-lived state with an appropriate wavelength that you can actually use for things. So what Dave Wineland was able to do, by using quantum gates like that animation I just showed you, we can also bring in another ion right next to it. So you've got two ions right next to each other. And this ion can sympathetically cool. It can sympathetically initialize the state of that aluminum ion, so on and so forth. So what we find is that we do our Ramsey sequence on this singlet S0 to triplet P0 transition, and we have all the entropy-related tasks are done by this beryllium ion. And the results of this, I think most recent results here, essentially they're now able to do a comparison of two clock frequencies at about the 17th decimal place. And that I think, is probably one of the most impressive results I've ever heard in physics. This is the most precise measurement of a fundamental constant by far. This is the most precisely measured constant that we have, okay? It's kind of a weird one. It's a ratio of two clock frequencies. But nonetheless, when you start thinking about what sorts of things come into play at the 17th decimal place, you have to think about things like the Doppler shift due to continental drift, okay? The 17th decimal place is a very difficult place to operate, but nonetheless, these guys were able to do it. So further reading on here, you can check it out online. And as my last slide, I'm going to leave you with a couple of quotes where both of these fellows in their Nobel lecture, which is published in Reviews of Modern Physics every year, were essentially talking about Schrödinger, who was thinking up a lot of these experiments, strictly as Gedanken experiments, essentially saying that, well, we would never actually be able to do this. And here, they've been able to actually do it in the lab, essentially ushering in the era of real quantum technologies that we hope will benefit all of us. So thank you for your attention. And he kind of gave rise, I think, to some later generations of that, where people are now actually trapping neutrons in three-dimensional traps where they aren't necessarily orbiting. You can actually get them essentially to like sit there, and you can watch the decay. It's fantastic. It's based on the same principle, but it's static magnetic fields in that case. But it's fantastic work. Thank you for pointing that out.
I just wanted to know about the part of, when they were talking about like a fixed state of a particle going through the photon chamber, and like they detected the proton on the opposite side. So how do you know that if it's if it'll interact with the photon like just once? What if it interacts twice and you just get the result that is?
So what you have to do is know the velocity of these atoms very well, and know essentially what the mode of this photon looks like very well. And if you have control over at least one of those things, you can make sure that the integrated area that this atom sees as it passes through that cavity is actually equal exactly to pi, for instance. So it's essentially a matter of making sure that you have a monochromatic beam of atoms that interact for an amount of time that you get to choose. You do it by having control over the amount of time that the interaction takes place.
Time for one more question. Okay, I have one. So in the Serge-Hiroshi feedback to keep one photon in the cavity, how do you get a photon into the cavity that has such a good Q factor?
Well, one way is to have a microwave horn that shines light into the cavity just based on the tiny, tiny fringing field due to the fact that these mirrors are not infinite. You can put a microwave horn right next to it. Another thing that will happen is at those temperatures, you just wait and a black body photon will appear, actually. So that's another way actually to produce that thing. I think furthermore, if you started that atom in the spin-up state and sent it through there, you could deterministically, at least in principle, I'm not sure if he's done this, you could deterministically have it emit a photon into that cavity mode. This is one of the things that he was able to demonstrate with this system. It's called the Purcell effect, but you can essentially gain control over the spontaneous emission process.
That's great, thanks. Let's thank Dr. Campbell again.